Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning. Welcome to All Exits Closed. My guest today is Louis Cespedes. How do you pronounce your last name?
Lou Cespedes.
And he's here to talk about the issue of immigration. So, Louis, you know, you watch TV, you see all kinds of terrible pictures and hear all kinds of stories. From your perspective, what is immigration right now? What's going on?
Well, first, Cynthia, I want to thank you for the opportunity to be on your show and to introduce myself to your listeners. Very excited to be part of your podcast.
Thank you.
I live in a district that is mostly composed of West Indians, a very large immigrant community. And the issue of immigration is not a one-size-fits-all definition. We have many different types of immigrants that come from all different types of circumstances. And I think that one of the things that we need to understand within the larger narrative of immigration, of what's happening currently in our country, is to distinguish what is asylum from what is voluntary migration. I think that what we're seeing right now, predominantly from our southern border, is a result of economic asylum versus ideological asylum. And I'd like to explain that a little bit to your listeners. Mm-hmm. I think as we've moved away from a post-World War II framing of immigration policy in this country, and now more recently a post-Cold War immigration framing, we are now dealing with macroeconomic and macro geopolitical crises all over the world. And this is shaping the composition of the migrants that we are receiving in the United States today. A lot of this is due to the corruption and economic insecurity that can be found in regions of Central and South America, certainly in Mexico, but also in Africa, in the Middle East. And it's important to understand that as we discuss immigration today, and particularly the issue of asylum, what we're dealing with is a profile that is much more aligned with asylum seekers that are looking for economic opportunities rather than what we've seen over the last 50 years, ideological positions.
So, you know, given the fact that the president is catering to white supremacists, and he's making people who want to come into the country very unwelcome. Now, people who want to immigrate into the United States, are they aware of Donald Trump's white supremacy stance?
Well, again, you know, I think it's important as we discuss this issue not to create greater tensions among people that have opposing views. Certainly, the climate in the United States is not one that has been friendly as of late to immigrants, and as well as we've discussed previously, this is not new. This also, you know, occurred during the Obama administration and for many administrations before. Certainly, people are aware of the new positioning in both the American narrative, but also in the law, that they are less welcome now than ever before. But I think what's important for us to understand in the American public is that the law really betrays the reality on the ground, and that as Americans, we tend to speak out of both sides of our mouth. We say that We don't want comprehensive immigration reform. Those on the left differ from those on the right on how immigrants should be treated. And we're not really coming to the table and finding middle ground. Certainly there is the sense in our southern border that the U.S. is no longer friendly to the idea of economic asylum or migration. But that doesn't seem to be stopping them from coming, does it?
No, it doesn't. Now, when people from south of the border come into this country, they realize the hostile feelings that are coming out of Washington?
I'm sorry, I didn't understand the question. Could you repeat that again?
Sure. When somebody from Mexico and, you know, South and Central America come here, did they realize that the president is really unwelcoming towards them?
Yes, I mean, of course they realize that. But again, in order to give your listeners a better context of why immigrants come here, I think we need to understand we need to have a better perspective of what's going on in Central and South America geopolitically, also economically. Mm-hmm. I spent 10 years of my professional life working and teaching in Mexico. I have a very intimate relationship with Mexico. It's a country that I love. But we have to understand that we as Americans do not spend enough time coming to terms with economic realities and disparities that exist in places like Mexico, Guatemala, Honduras. And we certainly spend very little time understanding how American foreign economic policy has brought those economies to their knees. And so, again, if we were to contextualize American foreign policy with our current immigration crisis, it's very easy to ascertain that one of the main causes of economic crises in those countries is American foreign policy. It is the International Monetary Fund. It is the unfair distribution of wealth within the oligarch class in those countries that force people in the hinterland to seek economic opportunities in the U.S. that they cannot find in their own countries.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So, the harsh conditions that they've experienced in this country, do they ever think of going back?
You know, I'm a Cuban American, and so it's curious because your question touches on something that's very personal to me. As someone that seeks asylum, there's always the hope and there's always the anxiety of return. And so, if we harken back to my earlier comments about the post-Cold War framing of our current immigration policies,
mm-hmm.
we see that this idea of going back really comes in two forms, right? We have the current narrative, which is send them back, which is something that was promoted recently at a rally by the president.
Right.
We have the idea of this, you know, voluntary deportation or returning home. And I would suggest that the answer is somewhere in the middle. I think that as a Cuban American, I am acutely aware of the incongruencies and the unfairness of immigration policy that my people have benefited from compared to other island nations like Haiti. which makes up a very large part of my district's residents. And I think the idea of going back is something that many people fear, because they feel that they will lose their opportunities, they will lose their livelihoods. But it's also, you know, caught up in this somewhat romantic idea of a nostalgic idea of going back to a place that you love, where you hope someday to find security and well-being. And unfortunately for many immigrants, the path to that future is through the United States. We are a land of plenty. We are a land of opportunity. And if I could just give you a specific example, Mexico's GDP is composed of two major components. One is oil revenue, but the largest component is remittances. And so the money that flows from the labor class in the United States back to those home countries is such an important part of those countries' economies. It's such a critical component that without it, I mean, most of these governments would collapse. And so, you know, the idea of return is somewhat based on myth and romance, but it is a greater and greater reality for many people here that no longer will enjoy the benefits of temporary protective status. It's no longer a reality for many people that don't feel welcome. And so going back could also present a host of new problems for the United States in the future.
So what you're saying is people who come into this country and they find employment, so they're sending their money back to their loved ones in the country that they came from, which stimulates that economy, correct?
Absolutely, certainly. It certainly does. And to understand that even, you know, in more granular detail, many of these countries, you know, I can speak of, you know, Mexico in particular, suffer from a non-existent middle class. And so you either have, you know, 40, sometimes upwards of 50% poverty in these countries with a very wealthy upper class that concentrates wealth. And so, for example, in the case of Mexico, over 80% of the business base is 1-3 person family-owned businesses where there is absolutely no possibility of upward mobility. And so you have, unfortunately, a very large segment of the society that works or operates in the black market. There is not a coherent tax structure. And you have many people that don't have the opportunity to go to school or to take on a professional professional skills or trades. And so you have a very large, uneducated working class with a very powerful and well-educated upper class. And this these stark differences in the composition of the public and their capacity to spend, their capacity to earn, is really what's driving driving immigration from those countries into the United States, because there is a middle class in the United States and there is opportunity. And so we have to be coherent as a nation. We have to understand what our policies, like the North American Free Trade Agreement and its new iteration in the USMCA, is doing to those businesses and what demands we're making of the political and business class in those communities to provide in those countries to provide more upward mobility and opportunity to their people.
You know, you brought up an interesting concept, and that's upward mobility. In the United States today, there's a dwindling middle class, and part of the problem is because so many young people owe so much money to the bank, college education. If we have a middle class that's dwindling, you know, that's not good. I don't see this country as thriving. What do you think?
Well, certainly the issue of our dwindling middle class has been with us for quite some time. And again, if we were to frame this in the context of our current narrative on immigration, I think anyone with intimate knowledge of what's happened to the industrial base in this country will clearly understand that it has been the initiative and the decisions made by white men sitting on corporate boards to deconstruct the industrial apparatus of this country and export it to countries like Mexico, like Taiwan, like China, like India, and that the result of what we're seeing occurring in the middle class in this country is not due to immigration. It is due to the exporting of American jobs. And I would argue that as we move further and further away from an industrial economy and more and more into a service economy, the United States is becoming an economic powerhouse based on distribution. And so the jobs aren't there, but the goods and the services are, and we need to continue growing the economy based on those new demands. The industrial base has moved south, it has moved east, and so the jobs that are available to Americans in this service sector economy are not apt, and most of those jobs are currently going to immigrants. I would like to remind your audience that not long ago, maybe around 2002, Mexican President Vicente Fox Quesada made a statement on American television that Mexicans do the jobs that most Americans won't do, and he even went and said that that they do the jobs that even blacks won't do. And there was a lot of pushback. There was a lot of controversy around that comment. But I would like us to really analyze that in our current economy, the people that, you know, deliver our goods, the people that work at our delis, the people that clean our offices, the people that tend to our kids, the people that work on the dairy farms, these are immigrants. And they make up a very important part of the labor force in New York State and in New York City, certainly. And without them, this economy would not be able to survive. This economy would not be able to perform the way it's performing. And so we have to address the dwindling middle class in our country without scapegoating immigrants. Certainly it's a crisis. But it's one that needs to be solved through other means, greater education, more concentration on debt. Student loan debt certainly is an important component. But to scapegoat immigrants for the loss of the American middle class, I think is a grave mistake.
You think it's a grave mistake, and many other people do, but there's a lot of people that are buying into Donald Trump's xenophobia right now, and people of color, people who want to come into this country, they're hated. How do you change that?
Well, you know, hated is hated is a relative term. Again, you know, I tend to believe that people speak out of both sides of their mouth. If the price of milk in New York State shot above the price of gasoline, if you were paying $7 for a gallon of milk in New York State, then I could guarantee you that our tune would change. The reason why we are able to afford and have the lifestyle that we have is in large part because of the services and the labor that immigrants in this country provide. And so I want to make sure that for the listening audience, we're not parsing words here. Those very people that make up the bulk of Donald Trump's base enjoy the benefits of immigration directly. And so although it's hypocritical, I think we would spend our time more efficiently building bridges to those communities and really trying to engage in a much more effective narrative on the left about what the realities of life in this country would be without immigrants. And I think that that's an effective way to illustrate that, you know, we all share in the bounty of this country as a Christian and as a Democrat. I think that it is absolutely crazy that we as a nation, as a God-fearing nation, would exclude or come to use such hateful rhetoric against strangers. That is not what we are commanded to do. This is not our calling as Christians. And it is definitely not within the foundations of immigration history in this country to show unkindness toward the downtrodden and to those that are seeking greater opportunity and freedom. And the day that we decide that we will fall into and buy into this narrative on the right is the day that I believe, you know, this country will begin losing its way.
Now, Donald Trump recently made a comment to one of his at one of his rallies about the poor congresswoman that had the guts to stand up and speak their mind, and Donald Trump said, "Send them back." Okay, and the audience was screaming, "Send them back! Send them back!" Going to be a campaign about hate, about anxiety, about ignorance, and I see over the next year and a half, I see not a pleasant time in this country when we as a society can talk about the important issues that affect everybody, but it's going to be a campaign on fear and hatred. What do you think?
Well, I think that's certainly true. And we as a society, particularly, you know, we as a nation have retreated from the public sphere. We've retreated into, you know, our own echo chambers. We refuse to engage. We have come to rely on safe spaces everywhere. And social media is no less of a safe space than, you know, the confines of our home and watching Fox News. But what we must understand is that there are echo chambers on the left as well as echo chambers on the right. And the only way we will break our current impasse, the only way we will get past the rhetoric of hatred, is if we engage in open and public dialogue, if we come to understand what our individual and corporate needs are as a society, whether it's at the district level, whether it's at the state level, or whether it's at the national level. We have to find the means to communicate and engage in constructive discourse. And right now the media is not doing that. And so we are stuck in a place where we can only consume 200 characters per thought. Mm-hmm. We only hear the things that we want to hear, and we are not we are losing the capability as a society to communicate, and that is a very dangerous place, because in that vacuum you have people like the president, you have people like many of his facilitators on the right that, you know, fill the digital space and they fill the airways and they fill the emptiness that many people feel when it comes to, you know, civil engagement in our society, and our politics are broken because we're not listening to one another, and we don't have the capacity, and we are in constant fear that if we do not follow the trends, if we do not move to the same to the beat of the same drummer, that, you know, it will cost us our votes, it will cost us our popularity, it will cost us our followers, and that's a sad state to be in, but alas, this is where we are.
So give yourself a little plug. Tell everybody listening who you are and what you do.
Well, again, my name is Lou Cespedes. I am a father, a Christian, and I am an architect by profession. I'm a building professional. I'm a writer for the Caribbean Times, a local newspaper in the 45th district, and I am also a candidate to city council in 2021 in the 45th district of Brooklyn, covering East Flatbush, Midwood, parts of Canarsie. And it's been a real pleasure to have the opportunity to introduce myself to your audience and to speak with you. Mm-hmm. Again, Cynthia, congratulations on your show.
Thank you so much. So, Louis, I hope, you know, you will continue to come on All Exits Closed. And, you know, as the political campaign unfolds, I hope you will come on and share your thoughts with everybody at that point. So,
I'll certainly be looking forward to it.
Okay, great. So, this is All Exits Closed. I'm Cynthia Pooler. And I'm sorry, Lou, what's your last name again?
Lou Cespedes, city council candidate for Brooklyn's 45th district in 2021.
Okay, so, you know, we'll talk again. So everybody that's listening, important, if you want to add to the dialogue, please follow me on All Exits Closed. Send me that direct message. So everybody that hears this, please follow All Exits Closed on Twitter. Thanks, Lou. I hope to talk to you again soon. And thank you, everybody,
thanks,
for
Cynthia.
Listening.
God bless you all. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you.